This is episode number 10 with senior data scientist Yao Tan.
Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. My name is Kirill Eremenko, data science coach and lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you inspiring people and ideas to help you build your successful career in data science. Thanks for being here today. And now let's make the complex simple.
Welcome, guys, to this super exciting and special episode of the Super Data Science Podcast. You can't imagine how excited I am to bring you this guest. And it isn't a coincidence that this is our 10th and anniversary episode and that I invited Yao specifically to this episode because I wanted to make it super special. Yao is not just a senior data scientist. Yao is my good friend and my mentor in data science. And we met with Yao a few years ago. We worked together where he was consulting for the company I was working at. I learned so much. And just to give you a quick understanding of who this person is, Yao has done everything. He has taught at universities. He has been an entrepreneur in the space of data. He has led a credit risk / model validation department in a bank with 20 to 25 people working for him. He has been a senior data scientist at Pivotal, one of the most forefront companies in data science consulting. So he's done pretty much everything you can think of in terms of data. And this episode is truly packed with value. In this episode, we discussed how to create models, why models deteriorate, what a churn model is, what a credit risk model is, and you'll see how those are used inside banks. We talk about data science, computer science, and cultural change as well. So Yao is currently doing an executive MBA at INSEAD, which is one of the most prestigious MBA providers, and he'll share his experiences from there. Also, in this episode, you will learn the three steps to assessing a model. So Yao shares his three-step methodology, or the three things that he thinks about when he's assessing the performance and longevity of a model that has been built, whether it's a churn model or credit risk model or any other type of model. Also, Yao shares his 80-20-80 rule. You've probably all heard of 80-20 in terms of data science efforts on data preparation and then data analytics. Well, Yao has a modification to that, which is called the 80-20-80 rule, which was extremely interesting to learn about. Then we talk about data exhaust and also how to continuously learn to prevent yourself from becoming a technology dinosaur. And you'll see from Yao's choices that he's made in his career path that they have always kept him on top of the game, and always his skills have been in line with what's the most brand new, what's the most cutting edge technology, what are the most cutting edge algorithms in data science. And of course, in this episode, we'll talk about some tools. We'll talk about R and how it doesn't parallelize. We'll talk about Pivotal R. We'll talk about Matlib. We'll talk about Python versus R, and you get Yao's take on it. So as you can see, this episode is completely packed with value. Can't wait for you to check it out. And now I bring to you my good friend and mentor, Yao Tan. Welcome, everybody, to this super special episode of the Super Data Science Podcast. Today, I have my good friend and mentor, Yao Tan, with me. Hi, Yao. How are you today?
I'm great, Kirill. It's great to be on the show.
Thank you so much for taking some time. Yao right now is in Singapore. How's the weather in Singapore?
Bright and sunny as usual. Lovely weather today.
Yeah, and same thing here in Brisbane. We got a bit of clouds, but everything's going well. And just to let the listeners know how we met, Yao actually works or used to work for Pivotal. So you were a senior data scientist there, is that correct?
That's correct. And I'm actually shifting my roles right now. So in a month's time, I will actually be joining a bank working on financial crimes analytics. So it'll be an interesting new journey for me.
That is so cool. Congratulations on the new role.
Thanks a lot, Kirill.
And the way we met is Yao was doing some consulting for a company where I was working. It was SunSuper. It is a pension fund here in Australia. And we really bonded, and I learned so much from Yao. And just to give our listeners a better understanding of what caliber of a data scientist you are, I'm just going to read out where your experience is. So Yao was a senior economist for a rating agency in Malaysia for 5 years. Then he was an entrepreneur for a pilot multimedia, a bank tech startup for 8 years. Yao was the head of model validation for 2 years. Then he was a head of credit risk management for 2 years. And then he was a senior data scientist at Pivotal for 2 years. Also, Yao is a lecturer, or was a lecturer at Monash University for 2 years, teaching about international banking and finance. And now, Yao, you're doing your executive MBA with INSEAD. So that is a huge variety of experiences. And can you just let us know how have you structured your career? How has it taken you through all of these pathways? And how does it feel to have exposure to all of these different industries and types of work?
Sure. So I don't know if there was any real structure to career. I started early. I did a master's degree in economics, and I thought, I'm going to be an economist. And I walked into the field, and it was fun. And back then, in 2000, most of the modeling type work was in the economics domain. And that's when I bumped into data mining, data science. And the minute I looked at the technology, I said, oh, wow, this is fantastic. But there was no job roles, there were no companies, nobody was interested in doing this sort of work. And so maybe that's why I started my own company, because I was quite passionate in it, I saw a lot of value in it. And I just thought to myself, well, if nobody's going to do this, I might as well just start a company and, you know, start working on this. And so one of the things I realized in consulting type work is you hand over a customer PowerPoint slides. And most of your models would be sitting in PowerPoint slides. So the joke we have at Pivotal is PowerPoint slides is where models go to die. And it never gets used. So doing my own tech startup then led me to try and actually deploy, build software so that the models would be used. And so that's what I did. And after a few years, I realized, okay, I've done this role after 8 years. You know, I was looking for something bigger. The company was doing reasonably well. It was surviving. But the main reason why I started a company, which was there were no companies working on data science, that problem disappeared. People started to work on data science and modeling. I joined a bank because they started to use these models to make decisions. And they wanted somebody on board in the committee to help them as they were making these decisions. So it was interesting, instead of just building the models, instead of just deploying the models, there was an opportunity to see how the models were used by the decision makers. So I jumped on it. And that lasted a few years until big data really exploded regionally. And I wanted a more regional role to see how it was practiced around the region. And also, when I saw the big data technology, I realized that this was a bit of a game changer in how they were processing things in the parallel mode, how cloud was coming in. The way we would need to build the models would be different from the small data. There would be some additionals, things that would come into play. And so what I decided was to join Pivotal. And yeah, so that's been the arc of my career. I did the MBA primarily because I realized that at a senior leadership role, you need people who actually understand the data science, but also are able to communicate to senior decision makers. And there's a lot of change management involved. And that's one of the things I realized that I didn't have as a skill set. And I did the MBA primarily to get that skill set. You know, it would be good if there was people at senior management who really understood how the whole modeling process actually worked.
Yeah, totally makes sense, and I think that's a fantastic step, especially with INSEAD, which, as you mentioned before that we started a podcast, that it's one of the top MBA providers in the world, and it's located in Europe, is that correct?
Yes, right. It's based in France, and their claim to fame now is that the Financial Times ranked them as the number one MBA program and the number one executive MBA program. So yeah, they've done really well.
Yeah. And how many people are in your class?
So my section itself, it's about 30 students, but the whole entire program across Abu Dhabi, Fontainebleau and Singapore is about 200.
And you have to fly to Europe to attend the lessons?
For some of the lessons, yes. And it's a very international program. You know, there's also another joint program with Tsinghua. So we at some point in time, we fly everywhere. There's one group flying to Abu Dhabi this week. Some went to Vietnam, some went to Beijing. So we take classes all around the world with people from everywhere around the world. So it's pretty fun.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. And so Taking this MBA is definitely going to help you with some skills that you've identified gaps or actually just developed networking. But from your background, I understand that you came into data science as an economist, right? From the economic side of things. Was it challenging to learn the other skills that are involved in data science, such as the software skills? And I remember that you were really helping me out to understand Hadoop and how that works. And apart from all the other things, like such as modeling, which is probably relevant to your economics background, you still have a great deal of expertise in the technical side of things, such as Hadoop and other tools. Was it hard for you to master those tools coming from an economics background?
I think most economists and most people traditionally trained in statistics will find it difficult. I gradually moved in, so that helped. And by that, I mean, so I always had a knack for technology, at least an interest. And I always, you know, I did my own web programming, built my own websites back then. So I had some interest. But I think the big jump that helped me was I started my own tech company. And, you know, when you start your own tech company for 8 years and you hiring software developers, managing software developers. After a while, you pick it up pretty quick. So I had that 8 years to transition and acquire all those technology skills. So that helped me because in the role of a data scientist, computer science skills, technology and programming skills become extremely important. And so I had a nice gradual shift from economics to data science during those 8 years that I was a tech entrepreneur. I imagine not everybody can have such a luxurious 8 years to transition.
Yeah, definitely. So that was, as you say, a gradual transition. And then after being an entrepreneur, you moved on to being the head of model validation for a bank. Was that bank in Malaysia?
Yes. So it was a joint role, both head of model validation and credit risk. Primarily, they hired me as a head of credit risk. And they then realized, you know, we need somebody else to do model validation because we can't ask the guy who's doing the model development to validate his own models. And they just looked around and said, oh, you know, you're pretty good at modeling. Why don't you take this role?
Yes.
So, I had that role. And so one of the things that I recognized as early as 2005 was that whatever models we built, I always felt that it was like a can of sardines. It has an expiry date. It will expire. And we never go back and check these models. And I've seen models that have expired are no longer predictive. The market has changed, the world has changed, and people are still using those models to make decisions. And as a head of credit risk, I'm now using these models to make decisions. So of course, I'm very worried about how well it's been validated. Has it been checked? Is it still working? And it was natural for me because as a user of the models, I was also very concerned. And because I had that ability, I could have a more intelligent conversation with the modeling development team and give my feedback.
Mm-hmm. Totally makes sense. And I can see how that joint role would come to be. And and that's exactly what we were finding at the company that I was working at and you were consulting for, that they had models that were deployed, but nobody had been tracking the progress of those models over, I think it was a period of 18 months or something like that. And what I learned a lot from that experience was that models actually deteriorate over time. Whether you like it or not, the performance of models is going to drop off. And I think we even found a model that was, I think it was a churn model, and we even found one that had a negative effect. So it was better to flip a coin than to use a model. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes. That's very common. And the specific circumstances, if I'm not mistaken, was due to a regulatory change in the superannuation industry. And this is common. Whenever you see a major regulatory change, a model built before that period will tend to fail just because the world completely changed after that event. And so it's very important to re-update the models after a major change in the economy or a regulatory change.
Yeah, totally. And just for the benefit of our listeners, because we have listeners of all varying experiences, when we're talking about building a model such as a churn model, what we mean is there's an algorithm that decides on based on a person's characteristics such as gender, how much they spend, how much they have in their bank accounts, their other behavioral habits, their purchasing, and other behavior based on all of those characteristics, the model will decide what is their likelihood that they're going to, for example, leave the company in the next 6 months. So that's one of the models that we were looking at. And so usually those models give you quite a good understanding of who the most at-risk customers are, so you can prevent them from leaving and do something about keeping them. But when a model deteriorates over time, the use of this model or the benefit of this model is minimalized, and actually can become negative. So it might not be any beneficial to use this model anymore. And so Yao, from your experience, what would you say about model deterioration? I know this will probably depend on the industry, but how quickly do models deteriorate over time?
It depends partly on what's happening around the world, right? For certain kinds of models, say corporate credit scoring, corporate credit rating, companies don't change their behavior that rapidly. They go through the business cycle. So that will last you quite a few years. For things in the retail space or marketing space, so take, for example, marketing. Consumer behavior is very erratic, changes very quickly, and those sort of models need to be, best type of models get themselves self-updated every week, every day, right? As new data streaming in, those models will need to be updated very regularly. For things like, you know, retail credit cards, they last just a year, 18 months, a year, depending on, and the big question that the person should ask is, has there anything that's happened in the world recently that could cause consumers or companies or whoever I'm building my model based on, but that will cause them a behavioral change? And that's usually a pretty big clue, mm-hmm. right? So that's just coming from a common sense perspective. There are specific metrics that you can track, specific model validation reports that you can track to monitor. Usually, I would recommend a combination of both the common sense, observing what's happening in the world, plus also using the metrics.
And so what would be an example in terms of common sense? What would be an example of an event that could undermine a credit risk model, for example?
Let's just say, you know, the subprime crisis where we had people losing jobs, right, due to the economy crashing and the unemployment rate rising. That's going to be something that's going to affect your model. It's going to be a change in the business cycle. Or it could be a regulatory change in what the government allows. So those usually are important events or triggers. And it's usually good it's usually good practice that you have a chronology, a document, that you write down where certain key events are. Because as a person who's now looking back at history of the model and the provenance and seeing how it's going through different versions, by having that document, which actually lays out certain key events, it helps them give a business context to what's actually happening to the data.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. That's a very interesting example. And we've already discussed or gave our listeners an example of a churn model. Could you, in a few brief sentences, describe how does a credit risk model work when one is used in a bank?
Banks, as part of Basel, they had to shift towards, traditionally, right, maybe 15 years ago, what they had was a lot of decisions were based on business judgment, human judgment, expert judgment. And they needed to move towards models because these models would then determine how much capital, the risk of their portfolio, and what the model said the risk was, that would determine how much capital they needed to provide. And that capital is a huge cost to the bank. So where the banks then need to use these models are both A, first, to make a decision, should I give you a loan? And B, the capital provisioning, how much capital should I set aside for prudential purposes? So it's both dual needs. And the regulators are extremely concerned about it from a capital provisioning. And business people will be concerned about it from the decisions. So they have similar needs, but it can split. Businesses might care a bit more about accuracy, whereas the regulators might care more about the stability of the model. The clash between stability and accuracy, the way I would describe it, is that it's like an F1 car. You want the fastest engine as possible to get to the end of the race, and you also want the engine not to blow up in the middle of the race, how to break down and things like that. So you're trying to constantly balance between the two, and the race car driver wants to win. He wants the fastest car. And the engineers will say, let's not push it that much. Let's make sure that the car doesn't blow up. And please don't drive so fast until you blow it up.
Okay, yeah, that totally makes sense. And you want the car to get to the end of the race, right?
Yes, so the banks use these models for those two reasons, the decision and the provisioning of the capital.
So does that mean, like, when I go to a bank and I request a credit card, that it's not actually just the bank teller or the person that I'm talking to, the representative of the bank, they look at me and they maybe look at my finances and they decide at what limit to give me, whether it's $7,000 or whether it's $10,000. They actually use a model that somehow analyzes my behavioral patterns or some other characteristics and then spits out the results. Is that correct?
Correct. So what's been going on as a change within the last 10 years is traditionally they tend to rely more on demographic. So when you first go in a bank, there's what we call the application score. I don't know much about you. You're a new customer. All I know is certain demographic factors about you. And most of the assessment of my risk is based on those simple demographics for the application score. What we find is that the application score is useful as a first cut decision, but it's not very predictive of the person's real risk. What becomes more useful is over time, I actually collect data on your usage, how much balance you have, how much you transact over the card, what do you spend on, what things you look at, do you do money withdrawals, and that becomes a behavioral score and a usage. Now today, what we see with the fintech world is that you have players like Alipay coming in, where they want to take advantage of a broader set of data, both from your social networking, anything that's out there about you. They want to use all that data because what we've realized is that demographic factors are fairly blunt. What is really very predictive is behavioral type of information, and the more behavioral type of information I have of a customer, the more accurate the model can be. And if the model is more accurate, and I know that you are a low-risk individual, I'm more willing to give you a better price. I'm more willing to give you better terms. Whereas if I knew that you are a high-risk individual, I would be much more cautious. So if the model is used correctly, it could actually lead to much more optimal decisions, which are fairer for society. Of course, then if the model is not updated and has the issues of an expired model, it could lead to very perverse scenarios where it actually makes this whole society worse off, like what we saw in the subprime crisis.
That's very interesting, and that is very in line also with what we found in the Australian pension fund sector or superannuation sector, that even though these superannuation funds are huge, right? So they like the 10th in size, so the not even the first, second, or third, the 10th superannuation fund. It has a total of $36 billion under management, so that's a huge amount. And the top funds are over $100 billion, and really pushing the boundaries of $1 trillion in funds under management. So they're huge financial institutions, but and they're like much bigger than banks. But at the same time, banks, in terms of modeling, they have an advantage because banks have credit cards that they give to their customers, and then customers actually transact based on those cards. So banks have they don't have that much funds under management, but at the same time they have a huge amount of this data that they can analyze and therefore assess their customers even better. Whereas superannuation funds, they're just pension funds where the money is just lying and it's accumulating until somebody retires. So there is no transaction information. And even though the pension funds or superannuation funds are much bigger in size than banks, the banks have an advantage of data. And so this kind of like unspoken war between the two, it's when we were discussing it, we were kind of agreeing that banks, even though they're smaller, they have this huge advantage, and over time they can overtake the superannuation funds because they just know their customers better. Do you still agree with that statement?
Yes, definitely. I think this is the shift in the. So this is where superannuations are going to be disrupted, right? Everybody in every industry is going to be disrupted. And what you just described is one example of how superannuation could be disrupted if banks realize the wealth of the are able to capitalize and leverage on the data they have. They could disrupt superannuation and take much more share. So in any business, if you are not observing of what your existential threats would be, and you're not having a good strategy to deal with this, you will not exist. And so, yeah, I fully agree with that statement. And even banks themselves, they are likely to be disrupted by the fintech small companies, which are leveraging on social networking data, tech data, because that's going to tell a lot more information of a person's personality and risk profile and risk attitude, right? And they will have more transactions on the, you know, on the social, you know, on the IT space, yep, than what you're having on financial transactions. And that's why you see the fintech world today, where they are trying to get as much data on your things like Apple Pay, Samsung Pay, because that tells you more behavioral information. And, you know, it becomes a source of competitive advantage. So you can see everybody, right? So how banks are thinking of disrupting the superannuations. You have the tech companies thinking of disrupting the financial services. And it's just, you know, one big fish eating another smaller fish and another smaller fish.
Yeah, totally. And I think you or somebody mentioned to me an initiative that banks were thinking about undertaking, and maybe this was even in Singapore, where some of the largest banks were actually thinking of installing cookies into the browsers of their users, of course with their consent, but using that to collect data on the browsing habits of their users to better build their profile. Is that still an initiative, and do you think that that is something that's going to go ahead?
So yes, that's probably going ahead. I've been involved in a few discussions, not banks per se, but yes, I think telco companies particularly are really interested, because instead of profiling a customer based on where you live and what gender, I could profile a customer based on what topics you're interested in. If I know you've been searching on cars and you're probably interested in getting a car, if I know you've just been shopping around for you know, baby food, mother care, and things like that. Probably you're having a child, you've got a life-changing event. Those topics tell me more about you. It allows me, and it gives me that rich information from a marketing perspective of what to market, how to market. So just instead of just going based on demographics, you can extract from the URLs what topics people are interested in, know that better, and be able to offer them much better targeted promotions or suggestions or products. I think it's pretty scary from a 1984 perspective. Mm-hmm. And that leads a lot to ethical questions of how models and artificial intelligence needs to be used. That's a large question Silicon Valley is asking itself. This is where the technology has moved ahead so far and what it potentially can do. And then the ethical considerations now need to catch up.
Okay, and that's exactly what my next question was. What is your position on this ethical dilemma? Should people be protected from their data being exposed and not being therefore not being used in marketing and other campaigns, or should it be completely available?
I think the truth of the matter is that there's so much data being collected. It's difficult for a consumer to completely protect. Say, you know, I want to opt out. And so, you know, just the thing is, it's an open secret. No matter what you try and do to protect yourself, it's going to good. I'm going to work from a position that no matter what you do or try, it is an open secret. That data will be out. Now, if I come from that perspective, then the organizations that have this data, they use this data, how should they ethically behave, right? Given the fact that the data is out there. And what are the considerations? And I think that it's very much similar to, say, corporate governance, you know, from a sense of a reputational effect. Organizations that misuse and abuse this data, they should be really punished from a reputational effects on this abuse and misuse. And so just same way we maybe punish organizations that are environmentally negligent and things like that, you know, they do bad things that... And same thing, we should punish organizations that are very negligent in the way they handle consumers' data. I think that's one good way of bringing the market forces, and the mechanism has already exists to punish organizations this way. The challenge then is, what if organizations themselves are not publicly listed? Should we bring in fines? Clearly, there needs to be some, the government does need to think about this and bring in some role into it and have some role into it. Just as the protect the consumers, that if the organizations abuse, it's not just the protection on the personal privacy, but when it gets loose, you know, what should government do to actually promote good behavior?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally agree with that. And I like that you mentioned that it's pretty much impossible to protect yourself from your data going out there. And I think there was actually an experiment conducted that how can you stop this data exhaust, right? So that we're constantly living our lives, we're using a mobile phone, we're using transportation, we're walking around in the city where there's CCTV and so on, and we're constantly leaving this data exhaust behind us. And I think it was even proved that even if you go and live in the forest for a week, you will still, every single day, you'll leave data exhaust just simply because there's still satellites flying above your head, still radio signals, still some surveillance methods. So there's no way to get rid of this data exhaust. And it's just a fact now that it's going to be out there. And the ethical considerations should be on the legislation side or on the corporation side of how to correctly use your data. And I'm super glad we had that discussions, and I would like to move on a little bit to your back to your career. So you were head of credit risk management and also head of model validation, a joint role. At that time, how big was your team?
It was fairly large, about 20 to 25 people, just because I had several different things. I mean, it was a large team within the bank. Mm-hmm. And I had a very large set of responsibilities. Not all of them were modeling. Mm-hmm. Some of it was just day-to-day reporting. Some of it was in putting in the infrastructure for analytics for the department. So it was, it needed to cover a wide array of issues beyond just modeling, also the day-to-day reporting.
Yeah, business as usual.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And so then you moved on to a role at Pivotal where you were the senior data scientist, and a completely different role, completely different transition. You went from managing a team of 25 people to actually performing the work yourself. And in a lot of our listeners' view, it'll sound like a move backwards. Instead of, like ideally people dream about moving through their roles and then becoming a manager and having a team under them, whereas you chose to do the opposite. Could you explain why you made this decision?
Right. So that's right. I actually chose the exact opposite. I had a huge important role in the bank. Credit risk is a very key position. And I decided to go back down to actually do coding.
Wow.
Why would you start? So I think what I did was I saw that big data was going to be a game changer. Machine learning, the whole new technology that was coming out was going to become a big changer. And I realized that I was going to be a dinosaur if I didn't jump and learn how to do it. I also personally felt that if I was managing a team, if I did not know the technology, if I did not have a good understanding, I would get less respect from technical people. Technical staff usually like to work for a boss who actually understands the details themselves. They may not need to execute, but they really need to have a firm appreciation for the issues. And so I thought it would be good to update all my skills with the new technology, such that I would not be a dinosaur. Now, so one of the things I made sure was every year, even though I was just in a managerial role, I made sure every year I took an opportunity to build one model every year, every 18 months. That kept my skills fresh, such that I could come back down and actually take a technical role and rebuild all my, update all my technology skills. That was, I think, that's going to be very important for the next 10 years, because as the technology shifts, I would have at least an updated set of technology. So it was an important decision from my side to actually just bite the bullet and say, you know what, I need to go back and do real work and relearn everything again. And I think some people may sometimes feel that all they want to do is just progress up and manage more people. Mm-hmm. But I realized that that can be a big mistake, because you will soon lose touch of, especially in the technology world, you will soon lose touch of how the technology functions. And if you haven't gone in and actually built things and do it yourself, you start becoming an ineffective manager.
Yeah, totally. And it's very easy to lose track of what's going on in the world. And so did Pivotal give you this opportunity to develop your coding skills? And just generally speaking, for the benefit of our listeners, what exactly does Pivotal do?
Pivotal was a great company for me in the sense that it's a very hardcore technology company. What it does is... So its main business is really to, it's been in Silicon Valley for many years. Pivotal was spun out of EMC, and largely what EMC saw was that, the new world coming in, the big data, cloud, their new set of technologies, which they then wanted to spin out as a separate company and not keep it within its the old traditional business. And it had a mandate saying, look, so there are three business areas: Labs, which was in agile software development and cloud, and Greenplum, which was in big data and with data science, a big team of data science. They put them together because these were the new technologies that was, you know, going to transform the world. And it had a mandate saying, take all these practices that was operating in Silicon Valley, which a lot of the established enterprises were not aware of, and bring these Silicon Valley type practices over to the established enterprises, the big firms, and help them disrupt their businesses internally, help them to make that transition to this new economy. So that was its market positioning, bringing what was done in Silicon Valley out into the Fortune 500 type companies. That was great for someone like me because I had a lot of that big company background. I had the small business background and I had transitioned myself. And so leveraging on this new data, Pivotal was exactly the position I wanted to be. What I would say that Pivotal really is at the forefront with regards to, they introduced a lot of new ideas and new practices of how agile software development needed to happen, how data science needed to happen. But what I also saw was when you walk into large organizations, there is massive amount of resistance. There is a culture shock and it stops becoming a technology question. It starts becoming more of a cultural change management question. Most Silicon Valley companies do not have to deal with this. It can be very insular. They just have to deal with the technology issue. Pivotal wanting to bring and disrupt, help Fortune 500 companies disrupt their traditional businesses, has to face this change management issue to a large extent. And one thing I realized is Silicon Valley doesn't have very strong change management skills. That's where the traditional consultants still have a very good role to play in because they've got a lot of experience doing this.
Mm-hmm. And hence your MBA now that will help you develop that expertise in cultural change.
Yeah, so it's not by design. It just by accident turns out to be a relevant skill. After coming into Pivotal, I saw, oh, this is what's needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And moving on to the work you did at Pivotal, because that's where we met and that's where personally I learned a lot from you. Like, seriously, I learned so much from you about R coding, about PostgreSQL, about Hadoop, about modeling. And I really want to give our listeners a little glimpse of that opportunity to also learn a little bit from you. Can you tell us a little bit about the tools that you used or maybe still use to build models?
Right. So the tools themselves are always evolving. Traditionally, it was always relational databases. And then there was this big move towards parallel processing and parallel data, massive parallel processing and Hadoop, right? Where that order of magnitude, that advantage is, instead of having just one big supercomputer, Google realized, well, this is not going to be possible because the internet's just too big. I can't fit everything into one machine. I can't scale up and buy a bigger box, but I can scale out and add more machines and have a cluster of small computers. Now, the challenge with that is when you have multiple computers and not just one big supercomputer, is that you have to take your problem and you have to break that problem to do the you have to split the calculations across multiple machines, right? And process that in parallel. That requires a different way of programming, a different way of thinking about it. But it also means that you can get your results much faster. And it also means that you can actually build models differently. So what Pivotal does is we leverage on things like Hadoop, which is a big data platform, right? And what I mean by that is it actually splits the calculations across all the many small computers. It's essentially still disk technology based and hard disk. And the problem with hard disks is that it's slower, right? Because there's a lot of mechanisms involved. And so there's a read write, the input output is slower. Today, well, very recently, with the Hadoop 2.0, there's a leverage on Spark, which is a memory, leveraging on the RAM, which has lower latency. So what I spoke to you last when we met, that technology and the tools that we use have also evolved. And that's just 2 years ago, right? So after you learn one thing in your eyes, oh, damn, I got to go learn it. But that gives the advantage on the memory layer to be much faster. So when you have real-time calculations, something like a e-commerce website any streaming type video and you need to do quick calculations, that RAM gives you an order of magnitude much faster, like 10 times faster in terms of the speed. Now, that's a big data problem. But most of us were trained in small data, just because anybody who did data science five, 6 years ago, you would have started to use things like R. Now, R itself is a great tool. It's pretty much a direct competitor to SAS. It's an open source tool. And R has the advantage because the academia, whenever they invent the latest algorithms, they just released out a lot of that in R as R package. And so you have very powerful machine learning algorithms, the latest available out there in R. And for me, that's a big advantage over SAS because if you really want to be at the forefront, R has that technological advantage, that, you know, the latest, coolest things. Now, problem with R is that it doesn't parallelize. Means, what that means is, it's if you had a very big data set and that can't fit on RAM, you're screwed because it'll just take you forever to do those calculations on R. It takes a while. However, where Pivotal comes in is where we actually sort of cross that bridge. We allow you to use that R code, and then we would actually parallelize it on our platform and split those calculations for you. We call that Pivotal R, or another component we have is called Matlib. And that actually breaks those. So you have the advantage of using your R code, but at the same time, you can actually do those calculations in parallel in a big data world. So that actually helps the data scientists because you don't wait 3 hours, 5 hours for your results to come, because that can be very frustrating. It just happens in a matter of seconds, and that's a huge advantage. So, what's happening now today with Spark is also that people are now moving more to Python. And the joke that runs around is that, you know, if you're my age in 40s, most people would be using SQL. And then those in their 30s, they would be doing in R. And those in their early 20s, they'll be using in Python. So what language a person uses, you know, pretty much tells what age you would be.
Well, that's funny, yeah.
Yeah, it gets pretty hilarious because you can see them as they go through the interviews and you're going through recruits. it actually shows up in that pattern as well.
Yeah, well, I'm 27 and I'm kind of like in between R and Python, but I kind of like R more. So I think that is a testament to this segmentation that you've just presented. So yeah, very, very interesting. And so you would say that Python is the new language of big data. Was that statement correct?
That's correct. And the advantage Python has is, first of all, it's closer to a proper programming language with proper syntax. Well, R is primarily functional programming, so that's good in its own way. But one of the challenges is that you actually have to deploy your model, right? You want it to be deployed. And Python gives better support when you want to move your model from development, which is great for the data scientists, but you now want it for production grade and actually get used, right? And remember how I talked about model validation, where the models will expire in a digital marketing space. It can expire very quickly, right, over a period of a few weeks. And so being able to move from development to production quickly is a huge advantage, right? Because you just get correct decisions. And that's where a proper programming language like Python has an advantage over R.
Okay, and it's good that we have moved slowly back to models, because I was also going to ask you about a bit more about these parameters. So you mentioned that there's two sides to model validation. The common sense side, so it has anything happened in the marketplace that might have disrupted the model, so just switch on your common sense and think that maybe things have changed and it's time to reassess your model. But also you mentioned parameters. So what are these parameters, without going into too much technical detail, what are the parameters that people who are interested in modeling, they should look out for, they should research, they should understand better, that will help them assess the performance and deterioration of their models?
The standard metrics would be accuracy ratios, ROC, receiver, what they call receiver operating characteristics. These are very technical terms, but at the end of the day, one of the things that you want is metrics that help you how accurate your model is. If your model is meant to predict whether did the customer default, then the question was, were you right? You know, and what was the accuracy rates? That's one aspect. But the other thing you want to look at is statistical significance, the t-stats, the p-values, basically telling you, did you have enough data? Was the result you found just by coincidence? or is this reasonably robust? Back to the issue that we talked about earlier on, between the balance between accuracy and robustness. So those are the two standard ones. Now, there are a whole bunch of metrics that go along. The third group really is from an economics point of view, which is, was this decision financially profitable, right? So it's useless if you had the most accurate model, the most robust model, and it doesn't make a big change to the organization because it's too small an impact, right? It only changes like some 0.001% of the customer population. Then whether you got it right, whether you got it wrong, it doesn't make much of a difference. You want to spend your time on the areas which has huge economic impacts. So for example, you're thinking of rolling out a model, you think it's going to have a huge impact to the business and grow the business, and it turns out it only had a small effect. Then sometimes it's just worth killing the model because it's not worth maintaining it. So those are the three things that you want to have in consideration. Different business prompts may have specific metrics that go along with it, but broadly speaking, these are the three considerations.
Yeah, that's a very valid point. So was your model accurate? Did you have enough data? And did it actually have a business impact? So totally agree with that. And it reminded me that you mentioned when you were working at that bank in the credit risk management / model validation role, that at some point you had somewhere like over 20 models that you were managing simultaneously. Is that correct?
Yes, so 20 was in the low end, actually. the target was to raise it to 40 within the next few years. And some banks have much, much more.
Is that reasonable? Does it actually add value to have so many models?
Well, it definitely provides a lot of jobs. So partly it's driven by regulation. And I think, yes, it's going to be a situation where... So the variation between the models aren't that big. You can think of reusing it. So what typically happens, and I've had this conversation with many organizations, is that they run these little POCs, proof of concepts, prototypes, and they see one or two models that works well. But this processes that you introduce that to handle just two or three models, a small modeling team, what happens is it doesn't work and it falls apart when you start having 20, 40, 50 models. In the future, that's where every organization is going to hit to, just a large volume of models. And they will need to think through for the future how they're going to manage this. And this is where having good proper systems and proper planning will help later on. Because what works for just two or three models will not work for when you get to 30, 40, 50. And I think that was the problem that the organization faced, because they skipped the steps of setting down the infrastructure. They just wanted quick results. And then once you got past a critical break-even point, it was just chaos trying to manage everything manually.
Yeah, I can totally imagine. And maybe in the future, we'll have some sort of like computer algorithms or AI managing these models, and that'll simplify things. So yeah, that was a very interesting part of this episode. And now I'd like to move on to some more questions about your experience and your thoughts about data science. So first one will be, what has been the biggest challenge that you've ever faced as a data scientist?
When I was young, I used to think that, you know, scrubbing and cleaning and getting the data was 80% of the problem. and 20% was just actual modeling. And that's what everyone always says out there. I've redefined it differently now that I'm older. So 80% of the problem is still scrubbing, cleaning the data. 20% is the modeling. And then the other 80% is actually getting buy-in of the model. With people that your model is correct. So just when you think you're done, you realize, oh my God, this is even harder. And most data scientists are not well trained in the buy-in process. We are numbers people, you know, we show it, it's logical. Everyone should agree. And no, the world doesn't work that way.
Love it. I'm going to call this the 80-20-80 rule of Yao.
Yeah. So that's where the other remaining second. And so, I think the harder challenge now is the buy-in process, because I think I once had a quote from a CEO saying, are you trying to tell me that for the last 30 years, we've been practicing and looking at the wrong factors? And the thing was that the model suggested that these were additional variables which made the difference, which actually were predictive, and no one was looking at it. And the CEO could not accept the fact that they have been looking at the wrong factors all these years. And it is a cultural shock, right? It is a mental shock to the individual. It will take a while before they need, kept wanting to see proof after proof after proof. And even though every single proof showed that we were right. Mentally, it was a very difficult adjustment for the individual.
Yeah, totally. And what is your recommendation on how to go about these situations?
There is no absolute rule to this. Having strong stakeholder support internally is one. Having the data is also necessary. But at the end, one of the things I now realize is that it's a very emotional decision for the individuals, right? And being able to allay those emotional concerns is something that's important because they have to have this emotional shift, right? It's not the mental shift. They can get the data. They see the data. They can make that mental shift. It's that emotional shift. And as data scientists, we're not really trained to work in that sort of skills. And it's good to have somebody in that team who knows how to use to help the customer make that emotional psychological shift. And the data scientist just needs to appreciate it. That's where that promise is not showing more results, showing more data. It's helping that individual make that emotional shift.
Yeah, very deep, very profound thought. And a lot of data scientists and aspiring analysts, they don't even know about this area or don't focus on it enough. And I can attest to that is one of the hardest things. There's so many people who can crunch numbers, so many people who can drive insights, but it's actually the people that can convey those insights to an audience and get them to, as you say, buy into this this truth that you're portraying with data, because data tells the truth. Those are the people that are most valued and become the most successful data scientists. Moving on to our next question is, we talked about a challenge. What is a recent win now that you can share with us? Something that you're most proud of in your data science journey?
So definitely, I think one of the most recent wins was when I actually helped a very large organization, one of the global top insurers. They had a challenge where the CIO wanted to bring data science, machine learning into the organization. And to do that, he needed to have the different stakeholders buy into that process. And they brought us in to help make that transition. And this was a very long project. It was challenging from all areas. One of the biggest challenges was what I just described, that emotional shift. It was a multi-country engagement, several countries. And it was multiple departments. So at the end of the day, what the CIO wanted was a buy-in across the organization. And I was happy at the end of the day that they actually made that shift. They actually had several countries and several departments actually raise their hand saying that, yes, we are interested in starting their own internal projects. So I was successful in actually implementing what Pivotal wanted, which was to bring and disrupt an existing business in a large established organization. And it was very, very challenging. I didn't have the necessary skills at the start. Towards the end of the project, I managed to acquire more of those necessary skills for the change management. But yeah, maybe one reason why I'm so aware of it is just because that journey I had to go through.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds like a huge project, and congratulations on that. That must have been quite a difficult process to get the buy-in from a multi-country organization. Now that we've learned about your experience, and you have by far a huge amount of experience in different areas of data science, both the entrepreneurial side, both the economics background, working with managing a team, and actually then working in Pivotal, performing the coding. What is your favorite thing about being a data scientist?
When you actually find something interesting, when you hit that insight, right, and it's just like that aha moment, right? It's like an inventor or scientist having made a discovery, or an inventor getting his invention to work. Mm-hmm. The satisfaction of doing a good job and having something that's been built and it's something that you created, that's usually the best part of the moment for me, right? Creating something and you know that you've done a good job, you're proud of that creation. Mm-hmm. That's usually the best part.
Yeah, and that's wonderful. And I can see how that can be in any of your experiences, whether it's being a senior data scientist at Pivotal or being the head of a credit risk department, a bank, or doing the entrepreneurial side of things. In any aspects of data science that you've been involved in, that aha moment is always present, right? So whatever you're doing, data science allows you to create things and allows you to drive insights and have that aha moment. And
I can totally agree with that. That is, it gives you that great feeling for the probably for the rest of the day. You feel so enlightened and so proud of yourself that you've found something so that was so hidden by inside the data. Where from where you stand now, from everything you've seen in data science, where do you think this field is going? What should our listeners look into to prepare for the future of data science?
This is a tough question. I wish I knew the exact answer. So clearly, as immediate, I could say that more models are being deployed. It's really you have one side which is really moving towards deployment of models, which is much more computer science programming driven.
Yes.
That's one huge direction I see because nobody just wants to have a model anymore. And you have some data scientists who just get very interested in the implementation and the programming aspects. The other side of it is also working on the communication because more and more senior stakeholders want to come in, more and more people from, say, marketing want to get involved, and they really don't understand this whole language that data scientists are talking about. And so, just being able to understand and cross-communicate with the business people dealing with the emotional issues I've just described, that's also another big challenge. And I see data scientists having to get pulled deeper into these two worlds. And unfortunately, there's no time to learn all three, both the data science, the computer science, and the business human aspects. So usually you find data scientists gravitating towards one side versus the other.
And which side do you would you say you gravitate to towards now?
So this is a tough one. So Pivotal is clearly on the computer science programming deployment approach. And then having done the MBA, it's clearly on the other side. So I switch hats every few hours. But at the end of the day, I think my core skill would really be on the business side of things. Yeah, so not so much on the, well, I am not too bad on the programming, but yeah, I gravitated maybe perhaps having made a huge investment in the MBA, perhaps more to the business aspects.
Interesting, and you stand as a great example of somebody who, even despite all your success in data science to date, you continuously find new ways to develop your skills to be an even better data scientist. And going forward, what is your career from where for you standing now? What does it look like now? So you're joining DBS Bank, and what do you see for yourself in the space of data science?
So I think where the new organization, which I'll be joining DBS, they've realized is that banking is probably going to be disrupted by a lot of the fintech companies, a lot of the Silicon Valley companies, and where definitely they are. So this is fun then for me because I'm joining an organization that's progressive. They understand the threat that's coming, and they're trying to figure out how to deal with this by leveraging more on machine learning. So I think that's where the skills will come in, where how do you marry a threat, a business threat from a strategic perspective with a technological advantage, and how do you bring that to bear? I think those are probably skills which I want to leverage on and have more experience. So bringing not just data science to the implementation, but really bringing it with regards to the business strategy, that will be probably where I should progress on next role.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah, it so sounds like a very exciting role, and sounds like you've more than anybody, you're prepared for it to tackle that challenge of finding the ways that a bank can be disrupted. And maybe, like they say, right? If you want to survive as an organization, take the smartest people and get them to disrupt your own organization, and then find how to fix those problems, right? So it sounds like that's what you'll be doing.
Yep, hopefully. Right, it was great to be on the show with you, Kirill, and I wish you best of luck with this endeavor. I think it's great that you're doing this podcast. It's definitely value for the society.
Thank you so much. And just for our listeners, that I'm sure that there are going to be so many that are like just captivated by your career and where you're going. How can they follow you or contact you or just follow your career to see where it takes you?
Right, so I'm fairly active on LinkedIn. I checked it several times a day. I like that platform. So yeah, if you could just contact me via LinkedIn, I think that's usually the best way. And I'm usually quite amiable to work with and get to know other data scientists. So yeah, I tend to ignore the recruiters, but with a person who's a data scientist and up and coming and interested, I'm usually always happy to share and connect with them. So
Wonderful.
LinkedIn.
Yeah, we'll definitely include the URL to your LinkedIn in the show notes. And one final question, What is your favorite one book that you can recommend to our listeners that can help them become better data scientists?
One of the lesser known book which I enjoyed, and I wanted to just raise this out, was this book called The Logic of Failure by this individual, Dietrich Dorner. Where it was interesting was he was describing how screw-ups happen and mistakes happen, and the decisions made and making all those big mistakes. A lot of it was just the misinterpretation of the data, the misinterpretation of how things actually happen. And I think maybe I just want to call it one point was a feedback loop. A lot of planning, people think of it in a very linear world, and they think that, okay, step one, step two, step three. But the real world is much more complex. There are lots of feedback loops. Once you do something, it creates a cascading effect. And the world is not linear. And I think that's the crux of what the traditional models have. We didn't have the computing power, so we kept all the equations simple, linear, bell curve. But where data science is saying it's different is because the world is much more complex. And his point on feedback loops is still not much known, but I think it's very important because once you do something, it will feedback. And so once you deploy a model to take advantage of a pattern, you actually change the pattern, right? The pattern will change because you've taken a business action. And that's also point of the model validation I raised earlier, where the patterns will change. And that was discussed in the book. And I think that's interesting because you have to realize that if you are taking advantage of a pattern, you will change that pattern.
Very interesting. It's something that you don't think about often, and really made me pause for a second that applying a model will change the pattern that the model exploits, and therefore the model will need to be rethought. So that hence the feedback loop. Thank you very much. That's a great suggestion. The Logic of Failure by Dietrich Dorner. We'll definitely include that in the show notes. And just wanted to say again, thank you so much, Yao, for taking some time out of your super busy schedule to share this knowledge and wisdom. I'm sure lots and lots of our listeners are going to find so many gems in the insights you shared today. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much, Carol.
All right. Take care. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it. I hope you really enjoyed this episode because Yao shared so much of his knowledge and expertise in data science. And I'm so happy that Yao was a guest on this podcast because this allowed me to show you a glimpse of all of that mentorship and knowledge that I was so fortunate to receive when I was working with Yao. And of course, I will aim to invite Yao again onto this podcast sometime in the future so he can share even more knowledge, because that was just an hour is totally not enough for him to explain everything that he can share with us about data science. But this should also give you an idea of who you should look for as a mentor for yourself in data science. What caliber of people, what type of people that will guide you through this very complex and very broad field, which is data science. They will help you get through it. They'll guide you. They will put you on the right direction. And hopefully this episode gave you a glimpse of that, gave you a feel for who you should be looking for as a mentor in data science. And you can get the show notes for this episode at www.superdatascience.com/10. So just the number 10. It's our anniversary episode. And while you're there, make sure to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Also, you will find all of the links to the books and Yao's LinkedIn. So go ahead and follow Yao on LinkedIn so you can see how his career progresses in the future. And I can't wait to see you next time. Until then, happy analyzing.